Today is Thursday, February 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, the WHO said that while there was ample reason to be concerned about the coronavirus, don't rush to call it a pandemic.
Everyday sensible measures that we tell people to do every year with the flu are important here. Covering your cough, staying home when you're sick, and washing your hands.
Plus, after 19 years of conflict in Afghanistan, the war there may be finally coming to an end and replacing an organ with a printed one. Those stories and more are all next. World Health Organization Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said on Wednesday, China reported 78,190 cases to the WHO, including 2,718 deaths. Only two new cases were reported in China outside of Hubei province. Globally, the number of confirmed coronavirus cases stands at 81,109, with 43 deaths affecting a total of 37 countries. But Dr. Tedros issued this caution. The increase in cases outside China has prompted some media and politicians to push for a pandemic to be declared. He said they would not be too eager to declare a pandemic without careful and clear-minded analysis of the facts. The WHO has already declared a public health emergency of international concern. That's the highest level of alarm there. Dr. Tedros said using the word pandemic carelessly has no tangible benefit, but it does have significant risk in terms of amplifying unnecessarily and unjustified fear and stigma and paralyzing systems. The WHO will not hesitate to use the word pandemic if it is accurate in description of the situation. Gilead Sciences Incorporated on Wednesday said it had started two late-stage studies to test its drug in patients with the coronavirus. Beginning in March, the studies will test the drug approximately among 1,000 patients at medical centers, primarily across Asian countries as well as in other countries with high number of diagnosed cases. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases in the U.S., explained that even with trials occurring now, it could be a year or more before they're ready for consumers.
From a sequence of a virus to a trial, it still would not be any applicable to the epidemic unless we really wait about a year to a year and a half. Now, that means two things. One, the answer to containing is public health measures. We can't rely on a vaccine over the next several months to a year. However, if this virus, which we have every reason to believe it is quite conceivable that it will happen, will go beyond just a season and come back and recycle next year. If that's the case, we hope to have a vaccine.
U.S. President Donald Trump spoke Wednesday evening, naming Vice President Mike Pence as the point person in his administration for the COVID-19 outbreak. He also reiterated that far more people die annually of the flu than have of the coronavirus thus far. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention's Ann Schuchat said the best way to guard against the COVID-19 is the same way one does against the flu.
Covering your cough, staying home when you're sick, and washing your hands. Tried and true, not very exciting measures, but really important ways that you can prevent the spread of respiratory viruses.
In South Korea, the United States and the Republic of Korea, the South's official name, announced Thursday they would postpone upcoming joint military exercises until further notice due to the COVID-19 outbreak. The statement announcing the decision said it was not made lightly and that their alliance remains ironclad. As the novel coronavirus continues to spread beyond China, health officials in Europe are ramping up efforts to contain the virus and care for patients. The European Union Health Minister, Stella Kyriakides, and the World Health Organization officials met Wednesday with Italian officials in Rome to discuss the outbreak in Italy, the worst so far in Europe. Earlier, my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson spoke with reporter Nicolas Pinot, who's been following the outbreak from Paris.
Well, the latest is from France, when a second person died last night. And the most concerning thing about this patient who died is that he's a patient, he was 60 years old, and he did not travel to any zone that's concerned by the virus. He did not travel to China. He did not travel to Italy. So French authorities, they're trying to see where he got contaminated. And there's also another patient. His state is pretty critical as of right now. And again, he did not travel either to a specific zone that was also targeted by the virus. Also today in Europe, Greece mentioned his first coronavirus case. And also we have at least now 12 deaths in Italy, which is right now the most concerning for Europe.
Now, European health ministers and other government officials have been meeting and talking in the past few days about the virus. What are they talking about? What are they saying?
You're right. They met this week in Italy to try to see the level of threat posing by this virus. And it's interesting to notice that the European Commissioner for Health and Food Safety, Stella Kyriakides, she's this Wednesday, she's in Rome talking with the health minister to try to see what's the situation right now. And she tweeted this Wednesday that she has requested member states of the European Union to review their preparedness plans and healthcare capacity. And according to her, it is crucial that they all inform people about the level of preparedness. It's key to mutual security. And regarding closing of border, European unions right now, they're not going to close anything, but people are starting to being scared and very concerned. As of today, you have a big soccer game in Lyon in France versus Torino city in Italy. And people, they don't understand because you're going to have 3,000 fans traveling from Italy, and they come from especially where there's a virus. So people are quite concerned about what to do, if they need to wear a mask, if they need to be quarantined or not. And people in Europe, they're trying to say that they do not get the right information about the virus.
So the concern with the public is that they don't feel that they're getting enough information from EU health experts.
Exactly. And also something that's been mentioned, right now you don't have any travel ban to China. You don't have any travel ban to Italy, for example. So people, they're free to go. But when they come back and if they travel to certain zones, where the virus is very active, then they can be placed in quarantine. So you have some voices in Europe, especially in France, people saying maybe we should prevent people from traveling to this zone instead of trying to create quarantines when people come back.
That was journalist Nicolas Pinault in Paris speaking with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson. After 19 years of a grueling conflict that has claimed the lives of more than 100,000 people, the war in Afghanistan may be finally coming to an end. So far, all sides seem to be respecting an agreement to reduce violence, a partial truce that came into effect last Saturday. But as VOA's Aisha Tanzim reports, an initial political crisis has threatened to derail the process.
The Surpul checkpost on the Kabul-Kandahar highway used to constantly be under attack by the Taliban. Since the start of the partial truce, the soldiers guarding the post are breathing a sigh of relief.
We used to face relentless attacks. Every day, every night, we faced immense difficulties. Now things are much better.
The same is true for shopkeepers in the Durrani Bazaar in Wardak province. They've even increased their business hours.
I used to close my shop at 5 p.m., but now that there is a ceasefire, I close my shop at 6 p.m. We have not heard any gunfire in the last 2 days.
After 19 years of war, the United States and the Taliban agreed to a week-long partial truce. At the end of it, if all goes well, they will sign a deal on the 29th of February in Qatar's capital, Doha. The deal outlines a roadmap for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan, one of President Donald Trump's campaign promises. It also requires the Taliban to negotiate with other Afghans, including the government, on the future direction of their country. In Washington, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said Tuesday the goal is to reach an Afghan solution.
Our mission set is very clear. We want to assist and provide structure so that the Afghans can ultimately get an outcome that is led by Afghanis, driven by Afghanis, and is a long-term solution that all of the people of Afghanistan can live with.
But the Afghan government is in turmoil following presidential elections in which two candidates, incumbent Ashraf Ghani and rival Abdullah Abdullah, have declared victory. The bitter standoff comes at a time when Afghan politicians should be building consensus on how to negotiate with the Taliban, says analyst Michael Kugelman.
And yet at that very moment when you most need that common united front, these long-standing divides within the Afghan political class have been exacerbated because of this political crisis coming out of the election.
Getting various Afghan factions to come together in one representative team to negotiate with the Taliban was already difficult. Observers say this crisis has just added to it. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Islamabad.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo this week urged Iraqi Prime Minister-designate Mohammed Alawi to protect U.S. troops and stressed Iraq's obligation to protect American and coalition diplomats, forces, and facilities. Pompeo also pressed Iraq's new government to end violence against the thousands of protesters who have gathered in Baghdad and addressed their grievances. Iraqi lawmakers have scheduled for a vote of confidence in the Alawi government, scheduled for Thursday. VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi spoke with Ismail Azlodani, former Iraqi military attaché in Washington, about the vote of no confidence and the pressure the government faces between anti-government protesters who want foreign troops out and its ally, the United States.
Actually, what did prompt this request is to remind the designated prime minister of his government's responsibilities and duties towards the U.S. and coalition forces, as well as the diplomatic missions in Iraq. The departing government has failed to deliver its obligations, as they have many times declared that they are obliged to protect the U.S. and coalition forces, facilities. As a result of that, the relation has been critically intense due to the escalation between the U.S. and Iranian militias supported by Iran. That ended in exchanging the shelling and strikes, and ultimately the Iraqi parliament's decision to demand from the prime minister to remove the U.S. forces from Iraq. The U.S. administration would like to turn a new page with the new government in order to restore the cooperation and relation to normal. Both governments value the importance of keeping diplomatic, military, and economic ties. It's also essential for the U.S. and Iraq government to maintain relations at the highest level, as there are many common interests to be achieved in the near terms and the future. I think both countries also are partners in fighting ISIS. The U.S. is obliged to build and protect democracy in Iraq, and the U.S. is a crucial player in building the capacities of the Iraqi institutions. So I think this is one of the conditions that set forth the designated prime minister from the U.S. administration, so he would gain some kind of support when he will be getting the vote to assume the responsibility.
So is Iraq capable of honoring this obligation when angry pro-Iran protesters have been in the streets calling for U.S. troops withdrawal?
I think the crowd who is calling for the U.S. forces withdrawal in the street has been mobilized by the Shia political parties due to the recent escalation between the U.S. and Iran. I think the Iraqi government is not entirely in control of the armed groups that belong to the Shia parties. Therefore, some political parties are more powerful than the government. But I trust that the new government and domestic players would consider the political channels to understand the importance of the U.S. presence in Iraq to defeat ISIS and build the security forces capabilities. It all depends on the new government's ability to move things forward and compromise the tension around the U.S. forces' presence in Iraq.
Pompeo also emphasized the urgency with which Iraq's new government must put an end to the killing of protesters and address their grievances. What do you make of that?
The prime minister, in his speech, stressed on bringing all who involved in killing the protesters to the justice through independent and transparent investigation. So I think Secretary Pompeo is stressing on the new government to hold the protesters' killers accountable and bring them to justice, also to address the grievances of the demonstrators. I see this statement as a condition also to designate prime minister to accomplish so he may win the U.S. support and so he can work with the U.S. administration to normalize the situation in Iraq.
Iraqi lawmakers decided to schedule a vote of confidence for the government of Alawi Thursday. Would the parliament vote in favor?
Apparently, the designated prime minister is trying to appoint non-partisans and technocrat cabinet. He is facing some opposition from political parties, but people demand reformation in the political system by removing the ethno-sectarian quota. So any political party would oppose this move may put the party in the confrontation with the people. Second, Iraq cannot tolerate more delays. Ultimately, the prime minister has to compromise with the political parties before the confidence vote, which I think will be in favor of passing the cabinet.
That was Ismail Al-Zodani, former Iraqi military attaché, speaking to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi. And later on the program...
A senior South Sudanese official has rejected criticism that his country is a serious violator of human rights. In a speech to the UN Human Rights Council, the official said facts prove the opposite to be true.
You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
A number of studies have previously linked the consumption of sugary drinks with increased risks of death from a wide range of causes. A new study published in the Journal of the American Heart Association provides evidence that drinking around 355 milliliters of sugary drinks more than once a day is connected to a couple of factors that can contribute to cardiovascular disease. The study finds that among middle-aged to older adults, drinking sugar-sweetened beverages can lower levels of HDL or good cholesterol, which helps remove bad cholesterol from the bloodstream while increasing levels of triglycerides, another type of fat found in the blood. The study also shows that drinking low-calorie sweetened beverages or up to 355 milliliters of 100% fruit juice every day wasn't associated with increased risks or adverse effects of elevated fats and cholesterol in the bloodstream. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. At least 20 people have been killed in the Indian capital during violent clashes between Hindu and Muslims groups over a new citizenship law. That's according to a hospital official speaking to Reuters News, even as an eerie calm has descended in the riot-torn areas on Wednesday. Reuters' Soria Ali has that story.
Riots sparked by its controversial new citizenship law, the worst of many violent protests since the law was first proposed, and riots that have overshadowed US President Donald Trump's visit. New Delhi police used tear gas and smoke grenades to disperse stone-throwing crowds. Hospital officials told Reuters they had treated over 200 people since the fighting first intensified on Monday, many suffering severe injuries. Prime Minister Narendra Modi broke his silence on the matter on Wednesday, appealing for peace between Hindus and Muslims. The law, announced by Modi's nationalist government, makes it easier for non-Muslims from neighboring countries to gain Indian citizenship. It has reignited long-standing tensions between the country's Hindu and minority Muslim groups. The violence coincided with US President Donald Trump's first official visit to India, where Modi pulled out all the stops in the hopes of securing a trade deal. Trump left India on Tuesday with a sale of $3 billion worth of military equipment and promised to conclude trade talks promptly.
That was Reuters reporter Soraya Ali. Kenya has for the first time allowed the informal visit of a UN envoy on extrajudicial, summary or arbitrary executions. Agnes Kalaman, a French human rights expert, met with the relatives of police killings in Nairobi's slums, where hundreds of cases have left relatives and friends of victims feeling powerless. Rael Ombor reports from Nairobi.
60-year-old Efa Kwendo lost two of her eight children in 2018, just months apart, when police in broad daylight shot them dead. She admits her sons got into some trouble, but she says it was nothing that would warrant the use of lethal force.
Apo si Robert ajawai shikwa aende kusimama kotini. Ajawai fungwa.
She says Robert had never been arrested or taken to jail. No one ever called to tell me he had been arrested or taken someone's car. All I know is that my son had a temper. If you wronged him, he would beat you up. Even my second son, there was nothing major he had done, maybe getting into little fights here and there. The deaths are just two of hundreds of cases of police killings that Kenyan rights groups have documented. This month, a coalition of Kenyan rights groups reported police last year alone killed 107 people, most of them young, poor men in slums, shot to death under suspicious circumstances. Reninga Mao sits on the board of Amnesty International Kenya.
When we stop recognizing these deaths, these extrajudicial killings, when we say that nothing is changing and therefore we will not document it, we acquiesce to these killings.
Rights group accused Kenya's independent policing oversight authority of not doing enough to stop the killings. IPOA says 142 cases from last year are under investigation, but admits only six police officers have been sent to the public prosecutor, who says few witnesses are willing to come forward. Nurdin Haji is Kenya's director of public prosecutions.
We have community outreach, and we are reaching out to a lot of these communities who are being affected by this problem, and trying to sensitize them, and trying to ask them to be more bold in terms of giving us the evidence. We are trying to make them understand their rights to access justice and how they can do that.
Kenya this month, for the first time, allowed the informal visit of the UN's envoy on extrajudicial, summary or arbitrary executions, Agnes Kalamad. She met relatives of police victims in Nairobi and Mombasa, and she called on Kenyan authorities to do more.
When after this killing, there is no investigation, there is no prosecution, and there is no justice, that's a second killing. And that killing is a killing of our society. Impunity kills our society.
Relatives of victims hope the UN envoy's visit will help advance the wheels of justice. Meanwhile, Kenyan activists say they'll keep documenting and publishing police killings until they no longer have to do so. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
A senior South Sudanese official has rejected criticism that his country is a serious violator of human rights. Lisa Schlein reports that in a speech to the UN Human Rights Council, the official said facts prove the opposite to be true.
Director General for Multilateral Affairs of South Sudan, Samuel Luate Lominsuk, praises the decisions and compromises made by his government. He says this has enabled the formation of a national unity government in the interest of sustainable peace and stability. He says his government is enforcing the agreement by negotiating peace with the South Sudan Opposition Alliance. At the same time, he says peace talks taking place with Sudan and the capital Juba are making progress. He says efforts to improve the human rights situation in this country are moving ahead. And this, he says, belies the UN Council's depiction of South Sudan as the worst country on earth in terms of human rights violations. He says this is contrary to the realities on the ground.
My government would like to reiterate that South Sudan has deep-rooted traditions and norms which compel us to respect one another in all aspects of life. Consequently, anyone who commits a crime touching a woman's dignity is severely punished.
A report published last week by the UN Commission on Human Rights in South Sudan describes in detail what it calls the widespread and pervasive sexual and gender-based violence in the country. The report accuses both the government and opposition of deliberately starving the population as a tactic of war. The UN Commission is scathing in its criticism of the government, which it says is riddled with corruption. The South Sudanese government did not respond to the report at the time of its release, and during his address to the council, Lominsuk also did not acknowledge the report and its findings. Instead, he continued to stress the positive developments and improvements in the human rights situation in his country. He called on the council to remove South Sudan from item 4, which looks into human rights abuses in specific countries reserved for those deemed to be the worst violators. Countries that will come up for review under that item during this month-long session include North Korea, Myanmar, South Sudan, Iran, Burundi, Syria, and Venezuela. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Imagine how life could change for so many people who needed a replacement organ if scientists could just print a new one that works. That's exactly one of the projects scientists at Wake Forest Institute for Regenerative Medicine are working on, 3D bioprinted human organs. Lizzie Bakalitz has the story from Winston-Salem, North Carolina, in this report narrated by Anna Rice.
We're printing an ear. So a patient had lost his left ear. They took a CT scan of his right ear and mirrored it so that we can 3D bioprint him a new ear.
Attaching them is still theoretical, but these 3D printers can print workable human organs like this ear. Scientists here at the Wake Forest Institute for Regenerative Medicine in North Carolina are working towards the day when they can print all kinds of replacement organs. It takes about 3.5 hours to create an ear, and it will be attached using a special solution made from the patient's cells. When they get it to work, it could revolutionize the science of organ transplants.
We basically categorize the complexity of the organs from flat to solid, with flat structures such as skin being the least complex, tubular structures like blood vessels being the second level of complexity, hollow non-tubular organs like the bladder or the stomach being the third level, and solid organs being by far the most complex. Certainly, the donor shortage is very serious. You know, there's so many patients on the wait list right now. And regenerative medicine is really a strategy that hopefully will help us to decrease the number of patients who are on that transplant list.
The process begins when scientists take a small piece of tissue from the patient. The next step is to create the desired shape or frame for the tissue. This is where 3D printers come into play, and alongside them, the procedure known as electrospinning, a fiber production method which uses electric force to create artificial blood vessels.
These are electrospinners, and the way that it works is we have a solution of a biomaterial, a certain type of a polymer, in a syringe that's being very slowly pushed out with a syringe pump. We have a rod here that goes through this apparatus over here, and it rotates and moves back and forth. And the idea is that the solution is deposited onto the rod, and it can form a tube.
Next, scientists test the artificial blood vessel by imitating a pulse.
We put it inside a bioreactor. So what we've done is we've taken the blood vessel right here, we've hooked it up to the bioreactor, which is attached to a pump, and it's basically pulsing flow back and forth through the blood vessel to emulate the beating of the heart. And so you can see, if you look closely, the blood vessel is opening and closing.
Thanks to 3D bioprinting, scientists can create more complex human organs as well. They are used in the so-called organ-on-a-chip, or OCP, technology. This 5-centimeter panel is a tiny model of a human body. Each chamber contains tissues from various organs. Such models are mostly used for testing new drugs for unknown side effects and even how they'll affect each patient individually.
In the near future, I'll say, what is going to happen is you're going to come to the hospital, they're going to take a small sample from your skin, and as the doctor is making your diagnosis and your prognosis and everything, a lab group is going to be building 20 to 40 versions of you, of chips.
Scientists can't say how long clinical trials are going to take exactly, but they hope that in some 30 to 40 years, their inventions will be a regular part of people's everyday life. For Lisa Bakalets in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, Anna Rice, VOA News.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition. on The Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Kelvin Fowler, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day. Thank you.